Today is the 50th anniversary of the Hawaii Association of Independent Schools. To celebrate the occasion, the Organization for Private Schools put together a book about its history. It was released in January. That's also when we had the authors and longtime HAIS leaders in the studio to talk about private schools in Hawaii. Our guests that day were Phil Bossert, the current executive director of HAIS, Robert Witt, the founding executive director, where he served until 2014, and Dan White, founding head of school at Island Pacific Academy and an HAIS board member for 12 years. We recorded this discussion in January, prior to school closings and distance learning amid the COVID-19 pandemic. We spoke to Phil Bossert this morning for an update. He says that the schools are anticipating a drop in enrollment. Parents have lost jobs and will simply be unable to pay their tuition. Schools are trying to expand financial aid, but Bossert still sees some drop in students. Following the Great Recession a decade ago, private schools lost roughly 10% of their enrollment. But there is some optimism. Bossert says HAIS meets with the head of schools every Tuesday via Zoom, and no one is looking to close their doors. On this HAIS birthday, we look at how HAIS began and the challenges of private schools during its history. Here's former executive director Robert Witt.
I came on board in 1989, but the association was founded in 1970, basically. So what happened from 1970 to 1990? 20 years. And so we looked very carefully at the founding fathers of HAIS. And then there was a second group of founders, if you will, in the 70s and 80s. And the names of these people will be familiar to some of your listeners. There was Joe Pinchon at La Pietra, Rod McPhee from Punahou, David Kuhn from Iolani, and then Jack Darville from Kamehameha Schools. And they were followed shortly thereafter by Dorothy Douthat, David Kennedy, Lester Sincade, and Bob Peters. And so those people created the infrastructure for HAIS and also a philosophy. And they believed that an ecosystem, if you will, of private schools would help all the schools. The big schools, in a way, needed the little schools. The little schools needed the big schools. So we discovered there was a theme that we characterized as independence. Yes, we had to protect that and nurture that, but also mutual interests and common interests. We just called it mutuality. And that's in all the chapters.
And Dan, talk about that, Dan. You know, it's a yin-yang thing.
Absolutely, the yin-yang. I think what got us started on the notion of how important the founding values were is that we talk about independent schools being mission-driven, and missions often are derived from values. Well, the association that was founded, in fact, reflects those same attributes that individual schools do. There's a story that it probably isn't apocryphal. It's probably true, but we've probably embellished it over the years. And that was that Joe Pinchon was sitting in his office at La Pietra, and in the old days you used to get films from national distributing companies, and there was a box that was sending a film to, or the company was sending a film to La Pietra, and Joe decided to peel back the address label and find out where it had been before, and discovered that it had been at Punahou about a month before. And it sort of, the light bulb went on for him and said, no, wait a minute, maybe there's a way in which Punahou and La Pietra could talk about what we're doing here in a way that would save both schools money. Now, you don't think about Punahou having to save money, but one of the ways you get to be wealthy is to make sure you don't waste money. So you look at that group that Robert was talking about, Joe and David and Rod and Jack. Three are from very large schools, but Joe is from the small schools. Yeah. It was Betty White that pointed out when we were talking with her for the book that the smaller schools in the state have really benefited from the fact that the larger schools understand the importance of this ecosystem. The mutuality, well, you mentioned that Robert had been before the legislature. That's one way. I think the accreditation process that we've developed in Hawaii, and we did that in tandem with California, is second to none nationally. It really looks, it's a strength-built model, not a deficit-built model. There's all kinds of attributes it has to it. Those are two specific examples of the mutuality. But as a head of school, I was hired by a board of trustees to look after the school that I was hired to look after. And so you've got that tension. You want to collaborate, and there are ways in which you can collaborate. But at the same time, you need to retain your own individual character. it's not so different than what we would see in general society. We're parts of community, but we're trying to assert ourselves as individuals. So it's not exactly a new theme in human history, but we thought it was really important to bring it out because that's where we started. And I think that if you look at the association now, that's where they still are.
And you all have backgrounds with accreditation. Can we talk about that? I mean, how you've been able to help other schools?
Accreditation is the way that we assure parents who are thinking about a private school for their child that it is a reliable place, a safe place, a place where their child will learn well, a place where their child will make good friends, and so forth. Accreditation is involving a self-study by the members of a school community of their own community and their own program. And they have to look at it very, very carefully and write it up. So the self-reflection process leads to improvement.
Kind of a 360.
It's a 360 kind of thing. When accreditation was first introduced in Hawaii back in the early 70s, it was really more of something that happened to a school every 6 years. When Dan and I came along and started working on it with Bob Peters and Dorothy Douthat and some of those guys, we decided that it should be more of an assets-driven program. Let's help schools understand themselves better. And that's what we've done. Also, we developed the licensing program that is modeled after the accreditation program. So we really, over the years, became a school improvement organization, perhaps more than anything else, and also a professional development for teachers organization.
We'll talk about the accreditation process. Have we had a situation where a school has lost its accreditation? I don't recall. You would know better than I.
Well, we've had schools that have been placed on probation.
Okay.
I'm not aware of anybody since I've been here that actually lost its accreditation. Generally speaking, if they were in that dire a strait, they would go out of business before that would happen. But having been a part of the accrediting commission that meets in California and includes Hawaii, yes, there are schools that in fact lose accreditation. And that, I think Robert's correct in saying it's a way that the independent schools can say to the larger community, this school has a clear-cut mission. It is serving its mission. It knows what it's doing. It has the resources to apply to that. It's one of those sort of shorthand things we say that about accreditation is that schools, if they're going to fail, governance and finance are generally the reasons. We don't think about the importance of governance, but if there isn't a good governance body there that is sort of assuring that the mission is being met, that the school is fiscally sound, that it has good leadership, all those things, that's a problem. It's a problem if they intrude too much. So governance is one of those things that's also a bit of a dynamic tension. And finance is obvious. If you don't have any money, you can't operate. And that's very much enrollment-driven.
Let's talk briefly about charter schools, because I know I've done stories on, you know, schools that have just had issues with either finances or governance and had their charters yanked. And we've had a number of new charters crop up. So who wants to take that question?
I think Phil first, and I'll follow.
Okay. So this is Phil. So when the charters first came, basically a charter school is a publicly funded private school. Unlike public schools, charters have their own board, and they can pick their own curriculum, and most of them have a 501c3 fundraising arm. And so they're very much like a private school. And I think a lot of people thought when the charter schools started, they were going to take all the private school students away, but that was not the case. Most of the charters have drawn their students from the public schools, and many of the charters have been started by public school teachers who want to do something new and different and innovative. And part of the founding idea for charter schools were they're called New Century charters, was for them to get out there, do innovative stuff, and it works, then it feeds back into the public schools, and that has been the case.
I recall, I think, when Island Pacific Academy first started, I know we've had a changing of the guard with a lot of the other schools that have been around. For a very long time. We've had the Punahou headmaster step down, or the president, I should say. We saw that at Kamehameha Schools, at MIDPAC with Joe Rice, you know, going back to the days of Val Iwashita from Iolani School, you know, Betty White. I mean, the list goes on. We just had this incredible brain trust, and then they stepped away. But there's a new crop of folks out there.
Yeah, Catherine, this is Dan. And actually, when I got involved in the book writing project with Phil, it was for really just that reason. It was my last meeting as a member of the HIS board, and I looked around the table and I realized when Betty and Jim left that the institutional history was gone. And so I never thought of a book. I thought, well, let's just write some stuff down here and make sure it's not lost, in much the same way that Robert was talking about. And Phil was the one that said, well, let's just make a book out of it. I'm a real optimist when it comes to that. And I'll give you a specific. This week I was involved in a luncheon for current school heads. Several of them we are trying to encourage to become chairs of these visiting committees to go out and do the accreditations. Now, admittedly, Bob Peters and I were the old guys. We were sitting there, and there were a couple of others who had experience. But as I looked at the table, I realized that kind of what I think David Kuhn was the one that talked about the new centurions, and he was talking probably about us. and it's pretty, you know, so now it's, you know, what do you do when the young Turks are old? But it's really reassuring to see that these young people are coming along and taking the responsibility, very much buying into the ethos of the public purpose of private education, of the need for collaboration and mutuality through the schools of the future is an excellent example of schools coming together and sharing information in a professional development manner, and then extending that to the public school faculties as well. So this notion that, yeah, we're all in the business of educating all of Hawaii's children is alive and well with those young people around the table.
Now, I recall with David Kuhn, I recall when Iolani opened their doors to girls, and that was a big deal. And then we saw that with St. Francis, you know, Sister Joan of Arc, and, you know, we saw St. Francis close down, and that was, I think, kind of traumatic for the community. But let's talk about that, about those trends, you know, where it's single-sex education, and then you've had also schools that either added, let's say, higher grades, or schools that were middle and then going down to elementary.
That's true. This is Phil. So over the years, we have seen some of the single-sex schools become dual-sex schools, dual-gender, and partly to deal with enrollment issues, but also to give different opportunities, perhaps, to the kids growing up. We've seen just this year, Hunnell and Waldorf decided to close its high school and consolidate back to a single campus. So there's various reasons, as Dan mentioned. Could be financial reasons, and it could be enrollment reasons and competition. There was a significant expansion in the number of private schools in the 1990s when the population in Hawaii of school-aged children jumped by almost 75,000. And so public school enrollments went up, private school enrollments went up, more private schools opened. And then during the recession period between about 2006 or 7, and 2012, 2013, 25 private schools closed. They just ran out of students, so to speak. But in general, the percentage of students attending private schools has stayed pretty constant at between 15% and 17% for the last 30 years.
That's interesting. Bob, what do you think that means?
The enrollment at the larger schools, if you will, remains pretty steady. And so if you look at the private school community as a whole, a large number of the students are coming from five or six larger schools. So that number never changes too much, and that keeps the average where it is. So that's the main reason. And as Phil said, as schools close, other schools open. So that's encouraging.
Robert Witt, retired HIS Executive Director, and Dan White of Island Pacific Academy, talking about private schools and the history of HIS, which celebrates its 50th anniversary today. They published a book, Building a Community, to commemorate the occasion. It can be found at the association's website, hais.us.